Chapter 42. Arabian Relations Set on a New Basis. An important event which took place in the same year as the expedition of Tabuk and the negotiations with the delegation from the Taqif was the death of Abdullah ibn Ubay. He fell ill in the month of Shawwal of the ninth year of the Islamic calendar and died 20 days later. Abdullah ibn Ubay was the chief of the hypocrites in Medina. He was a man of high standing among his people. Indeed, he was their choice for king shortly before they came to know about Islam. When the people of Medina began to embrace Islam, they saw no need to choose a leader, since it was taken for granted that the Prophet was the only leader of the Muslim community. Over the years, Abdullah ibn Ubay demonstrated that he did not really believe in Islam. He maintained his close relationship with the Jews of Medina and took their side against the Prophet on more than one occasion. He deserted the Muslim army just before the start of the Battle of Uhud. On several occasions, he expressed hostile feelings towards the Prophet and the Muslims generally. He was well known to be a hypocrite. The hypocrite dies. His past, however, did not prevent the Prophet from visiting him during his illness. The Prophet realized that Abdullah ibn Ubay was dying and said to him, "I have repeatedly told you not to love the Jews." Abdullah ibn Ubay was unrepentant. He said, "Asid ibn Zurara hated them, but what benefit was that to him?" Asid ibn Zurara was one of the very early people from Medina to embrace Islam. He died soon after Islam was established in Medina. Abdullah ibn Ubay then said to the Prophet, "Messenger of God, this is not the time for speaking about past events. I am dying. May I ask you to be present when they prepare me for burial? May I further ask you to give me the garment you wear next to your skin so that I may be wrapped with it? Pray for me and ask God to forgive me." The Prophet did so. A different report suggests that when Abdullah ibn Ubay died, his son, who was also called Abdullah and was a good Muslim, came to the Prophet and asked him to give him his shirt to wrap his father with. The Prophet did so. Abdullah then asked the Prophet to offer the prayer for the deceased for his father, and the Prophet agreed. As he got up to walk with Abdullah to offer that prayer for the dead man, Umar ibn al-Khattab held him by his robe and said, "Messenger of God, are you going to pray for him when God has enjoined you not to do so?" The Prophet said, "God has given me the choice when he said, 'Pray for their forgiveness or do not pray for it.' If you pray for their forgiveness 70 times, God will not forgive them." 980. Omar still persisted. He questioned the Prophet on his prayer for a confirmed hypocrite who was always hostile to Islam. He quoted what Abdullah ibn Ubay had said on several occasions. The Prophet then said to him, "Let me alone, Umar. I have been given a choice. If I knew that he would be forgiven, should I pray for him more than 70 times, I would certainly do so." Umar later reflected that he had thrust himself in this matter in a rather impertinent way. He was happy, however, when new Quranic revelations judged his attitude to be the right one. In this revelation, God instructs the Prophet never to pray for a confirmed hypocrite again. Never pray for any one of them when he dies, and never stand at his grave. 984. Abdullah ibn Ubay died when Islam was the supreme power in Arabia. The expedition to Tabuk was the last expedition during the lifetime of the Prophet. Since Makkah declared its loyalty to Islam, it was clear that no force in Arabia could mount any resistance to Islam. It has been seen how the Taqif, one of the most powerful of Arabian tribes, opted voluntarily to make peace with Islam and to accept the new faith. The Taqif were the last hope for the forces opposed to Islam. When they became Muslim, there was no longer any possibility of any Arabian tribe mounting a campaign against the Muslim state. There were, of course, numerous Arabian tribes scattered all over the peninsula, which had not made their position clear in one sense or the other about Islam. None of them was powerful enough to stand up to the might of the Muslim state. They were expected to make their position clear shortly. How delegations from various tribes started arriving in Medina to declare their loyalty and acceptance of Islam is described in the next two chapters. At the individual level, there were still a large number of unbelievers from all Arabian tribes. It was not to be expected that people would change their faith simply because the chief of their tribe issued his orders to them to do so. Faith remains a matter for the individual. although idols were destroyed, especially the main ones like Al-Lat and Al-Uzza, and despite the fact that the Kaaba itself was now free of all idols, there were still people in Arabia who believed in idol worship. They carried on with their old habits and practices, some of which were offensive to Islam, especially in matters of worship. Moreover, those who accepted Islam needed time to learn about their new faith and to appreciate its moral values. It was not to be expected that they would change their lifestyle overnight or become well-versed in Islam in a few days. It was time then for the Prophet to consolidate the gains Islam had made over the last 2 years by confirming Islamic habits and practices. Abu Bakr leads the pilgrimage. The Prophet and the Muslim army came back from the expedition of Tabuk in the month of Ramadan. 2 months later, the Prophet sent Abu Bakr, his closest companion, to do the pilgrimage and to be the Amir of Muslim pilgrims. 300 Muslims from Medina went with Abu Bakr. The Prophet sent with him 20 camels to be slaughtered in Mecca on his behalf. He appointed Najiyah ibn Jundab from Aslam to look after those camels. Abu Bakr took 5 more camels with him as his own sacrifice. The purpose of his pilgrimage was to make the difference clear between the Islamic way of pilgrimage and that of the unbelievers. The unbelievers used to do their tawaf naked. They felt that their nudity was a sign of their consecration of the Kaaba. They said that if they went around the Kaaba stark naked, they would not be wearing anything which smacked of injustice. That was absurd logic. Notice for all non-Muslim Arabs. When Abu Bakr had gone part of the way towards his destination, Surah 9 of the Quran, entitled Repentance, was revealed. It starts with a declaration terminating all past treaties made between the Prophet and the Arabian tribes, with the exception of those tribes which were absolutely faithful to the terms of their treaties. A period of grace lasting 4 months was announced. It was necessary to convey that message to all Arabian tribes, most importantly, those who were parties to such treaties. The approaching pilgrimage season was the proper occasion for the termination of treaties to be announced. The Prophet consulted his companions, and they suggested that he should send someone to inform Abu Bakr of the new stand in order to declare it there. The Prophet said, "Only a man from my own household should convey this on my behalf." This was in keeping with social traditions of the time. The Prophet summoned his cousin, Ali ibn Abi Talib, and gave him the following instructions. "Take out this new revelation of the beginning of the surah and declare to all people on the day of sacrifice, when they have assembled in Mina, that no unbeliever will go into heaven, and no unbeliever may offer the pilgrimage after this year. No one is allowed to do the tawaf naked, and whoever has a covenant or a treaty with the Prophet, that treaty will be honored for the full length of its term." Ali traveled fast on the Prophet's own she-camel, Al-Adba. When he caught up with Abu Bakr, the latter asked him whether he was appointed a leader or was merely joining him to remain under his leadership. Ali said that Abu Bakr remained the leader of that expedition. They traveled together, and Abu Bakr looked after the Muslim party as they offered their pilgrimage rituals. Choosing the grand day of pilgrimage, which is the day of sacrifice, for the announcement of the termination of all treaties previously made between the Prophet and all unbelievers, was ordered by God in the second verse of the surah. It was the most natural choice, since all Arabian tribes would normally be represented by their pilgrims, who were certain to convey the contents of the announcement to their peoples. Thus, all Arabia was certain to know of the termination of treaties, and no one could make an excuse of ignorance. On the appointed day, that is, on the 10th of Dhul-Hijjah, when all pilgrims were in Mina, Ali made his declaration. "This is an address to all people. Let them all know that no unbeliever may be admitted into heaven. No unbeliever is allowed to offer the pilgrimage after this season, and no one is allowed to do the tawaf around the Kaaba in the nude. Whoever has a treaty with the Prophet, that treaty will be honored for its full term. Those who do not have a treaty with the Prophet are hereby given a 4 months' notice." Abu Bakr dispatched several people to make the same declaration at the encampments of various tribes so that everybody would hear of it on the same day. Claiming Arabia as the land of Islam. What this declaration amounted to was a determination to make Arabia a land of Islam, to which no other grouping might have a claim. The announcement told the unbeliever Arabs, that they had to define their attitude towards Islam by either accepting it or leaving its land. They had 4 months to make up their minds. All the Arabs knew that Muslims honored their pledges. A period of grace was indeed a period of grace. Everyone, therefore, was safe and secure for that period. Everyone had ample time to organize his affairs and make his arrangements. If any person did not wish to be a Muslim, he would be able to liquidate his business, recover his debts, and do whatever he liked in preparation for the new relationship. Moreover, those who had treaties with the Muslims and were faithful to the terms of their treaties were given a new confirmation that the treaty was to be honored by the Prophet and the Muslims up to its last day. There could be no renewal. If any treaty lapsed before the end of 4 months, then those who had that treaty would enjoy the longer period of 4 months. This applied only to the unbelievers of Arabia. It amounted to the total liquidation of idolatry from that land. It was indeed a well-considered step to make Arabia the base of the Islamic message. As for the unbelievers in other parts of the world, they could coexist peacefully with Islam and the Muslim state. What was expected of them was not to oppose and not to fight the Muslim state or back any power which was at war with the Muslim state. Many writers and commentators have spoken on this declaration. Many have written apologetically, trying to justify that declaration by showing that Islam was pushed into this attitude. Such an apologetic stance is absolutely unnecessary. Firstly, a campaign against polytheism is similar to a campaign to combat illiteracy. Both are noble objectives. No one who wishes mankind well may raise any objection against either. For man to worship idols of stone or gold is to sink very low into the depths of ignorance. Moreover, Islam spared no effort over a period of 22 years to make people realize what evils they brought on themselves by worshiping statues and idols. The opposition to its call was simply an opposition which served the interests of certain leaders and groups who did not care for the well-being of mankind. Now that the issues were absolutely clear and the opposition to Islam was no longer a matter of mistaken concepts, only those who harbored no good intentions towards Muslims and Islam were expected to hold to their idolatrous beliefs. They were a source of danger which had to be stamped out. Secondly, the experience of those 22 years had shown absolutely clearly that there could be no real coexistence between Islam and polytheism. They were two fundamentally different ways of life. Indeed, they differ on every point of detail in matters of faith, morals, and social values, as well as in their economic, political, and social setup. It is not to be expected that such radically opposed concepts of life can coexist peacefully for any length of time. Every step either of them takes must be totally and completely opposed to the attitude of the other. The clash between them was inevitable at every turn. Some people may try to exploit this event in order to accuse Islam of standing against freedom of belief. They may cite the example of a person who wishes to continue to worship idols but does not take any hostile attitude towards Islam. They may ask, why should such a person be made to leave his Arabian home and seek to live somewhere away from Arabia? They forget that the concern here is the security of the Muslim state. The past history of relations between polytheism and Islam, and indeed the experience of the generations which followed, confirm beyond any doubt that the unbelievers would spare no effort, miss no chance, and collaborate with any third party in order to undermine Islam. Now that Arabia was overwhelmingly a Muslim land, it was time to make it a land purely for Islam. The unbelievers must not be allowed to conspire against Islam in its own backyard. One must not forget that those regulations applied only to the Arabian Peninsula. At no stage in Islamic history did unbelievers outside Arabia fear any personal or religious persecution by the Muslim state, as long as they did not meddle in its affairs. Followers of other religions, such as Christians and Jews, are treated differently. They may be citizens in the Muslim state, provided that they respect the rules and laws of that state. Any act of treachery or aggression against Islam is dealt with firmly by the Muslim state. If they maintain their peace with the Muslim state, they are given the right to be protected by the state. This protection means that they're free to live, work, and worship in complete security. Islam needs no preaching about tolerance. Its history shows that it has always been the most tolerant of religions. Tolerance, however, does not mean allowing a confirmed enemy to live and prosper in one's own backyard, knowing for certain that he will seize the first chance to evict his enemy. That was always the attitude of the unbelievers, as history has clearly shown. A serious religion like Islam cannot tolerate that without taking a firm and positive attitude. That was represented in the declaration which Ali announced on behalf of the Prophet on the grand day of pilgrimage.